Good morning, everybody, and welcome. Today, I am extremely lucky to have a very special guest with me on Kate Cook's Corporate Wellness Show. So it's Richard. Now, tell me how you pronounce your name. It's probably very easy.
Good morning, Kate. The last name is pronounced Safir,
and you would not
be the first person to ask how it's pronounced, but we'll just call me Rich for today, if that's okay with you.
Yes, because I would have made a complete hash of that. So I'm so glad you've put me in the loop there. But you are a medical doctor, a family doctor, but you have this great passion for well-being generally, a degree in nutrition as well.
Sure.
So do you want to give us a little bit of background and how you come to, you know, really being passionate about changing the health inside corporations?
Yeah, when I was right out of residency training and in a family medicine practice in a suburban neighborhood, after a year, I started to realize that if the patients were making healthier choices, then they probably wouldn't need to see me, or at least most of them. And after reading a journal article and then two and three about companies who are making good progress supporting the health and well-being of their workforce, I decided that that's where I wanted to be. Part of it was driven by how much I enjoyed my nutrition education and recognized how much even that one change, although there's lots of things we can do, can really help our health and well-being.
I'm on mute, which is the classic, isn't it? So tell me how you managed to sort of transition from, because I know you're still doctoring for sure, but how do you realize that the corporations kind of should take up this mantle of looking after people's health?
Yeah, well, the patients I was seeing, the adult patients, almost all of them were working. And so it made sense to me that they're spending the majority of their waking hours on their job. So that would be the ideal place to try to support them. And so then I needed to pivot. I took a job at George Washington University on faculty, where I was able to see patients, do some teaching, and continue this research around how employers could effectively support the health and well-being of their workforce. And then, Kate, fast forward two more jobs, and then my fifth job, I landed at Johns Hopkins 10 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, Johns Hopkins, for those British listeners, obviously is an absolutely massive, stonking great institution, one of the most famous in the world. I mean, really quite a big feather in your cap, not least through hard work, I'm sure, Rich. But it's an amazing institution. So, do you do this work under their auspice, or do you do it kind of under your own sort of drive and passion?
Oh, well, it's my passion. I'm fortunate to have found a career path that I love, and I'm also fortunate and privileged to be employed by Johns Hopkins Medicine to support the health and well-being of the 42,000 employees. So this is, this is my way of contributing to the institution, which does support the health of people around the world.
Yeah, and so it's interesting because obviously you've almost got a sort of little kind of, what do you call it, a little village there of which you can, you know, make some of your, theories that you've kind of come to in your new book, which we'll talk about in a minute, and how you can influence for the better culture, really, because, you know, in your medical practice, you may be seeing the end result of not looking after yourself. I mean, that's really where it is, isn't it? I mean, we medicalize or we give medicine to people at the end root of bad lifestyle. Is that true? And how much of it is true and how much of it is down to bad luck?
So, Kate, for full transparency, I saw my last patient a year ago. I was practicing or seeing patients at least some portion of my job for 25 years. I mean, as a physician, personally, I always wanted to try and support my patients with helping them build skills so that they could make healthier choices and avoid medicine and avoid surgery. But unfortunately, There's a lot of forces working against them, one of which is their employer. And so all too often we look to the individual and say, hey, this is your job. And we overlook the unhealthy influences in their life. And one of the major influences in each of our lives, at least for those of us who are employed, is where we work. And so the culture of the workplace plays a critical role in the ability for an employee to succeed on getting on a healthy and well path.
Yeah, that's very true. Because if I always say to people, you know, in effect, what, because when I'm teaching in big corporations, we were just saying before we came on, sometimes it can be a bit of a tick box exercise where people get the nutritionist or get the so-and-so or get the person who does the sound bath gong thing, you know, it's like, great, but it doesn't, you know, they might enjoy it at the time, but it's about actually how they take that information away and actually enact it, first of all. And second of all, actually, the thing that prevents them is that four-letter word, which is the work in the first place, because they don't allow them the time actually to take time off to go and see the nutritionist at lunch, but they have to use their own lunchtime.
Yeah, so, you know, yeah, absolutely. Kate, if the employer's doing their job, if they're creating that well-being culture, then it makes you more effective. Because when you go in and work with the individual employees, they are learning and gaining a lot. And then when they leave that meeting with you, they want to be in a work environment that's going to reinforce and make it easier for them to follow the path that the two of you set out together.
So how much emphasis do you think the sort of well-being culture should have? I mean, you know, as I say, I think obviously the corporation is set up in effect to make profit, isn't it? I mean, that's what they're kind of game is. So yeah. Of course, working people very hard and you know, as we've sort of alluded to, paying lip service to well-being is great, but actually how do we kind of get the corporation to see that actually this may be in their own interest, a
without
and
a doubt.
B, it might be, you know, something that really distinguishes them from the herd.
Oh, without a doubt. This is a business strategy, without a doubt. So the well-being of the workforce is foundational. Everything that the business wants to do is going to be more successful with a healthy and well workforce. So if the company wants to retain employees, they're going to be much more likely to keep their workforce if the employees feel like they're cared for and their health and well-being is supported. If the company wants to be more profitable, if they have a healthy and well workforce, that means the employees are more effective in their job. They're costing less because they don't have to get as many prescription drugs. They're less likely to get surgery. If the employer wants to attract more talents to bring into their workforce, then they're going to be better served if they create this well-being culture, because the employees who work there are going to love it. And then they're going to be their best marketing tool, because they're going to go out and tell their friends and their family, I love working at company X because they support my health and well-being. And the list goes on.
Well, I know you've got, we're going to talk about in a minute, you've got almost like a matrix of how you kind of implement this plan in effect, like a blueprint. But, you know, what I find is sometimes, and it may, you may have the strategic answer to this, which is mm-hmm. if I go into companies, sometimes it is I get all the fans who love nutrition. You know, they stay behind, ask nutrition questions. I feel quite the superstar, you know, which is great.
Sure.
But what I'm missing out is all the people who are still stuck at their desk,
right?
Who have got their, you know, sucking up a soda and stuffing in some cereal from a box beside
yes.
their desk. So is that a sort of culture thing, or is that a sort of, I suppose it's a culture thing, isn't it? Sorry, I'm answering my own question there.
Well, maybe. So let's say you have a company of 1,000 people, then you have 1,000 different employees who are on different well-being journeys. And some of them may hold their food in high regard and what they eat, but others may be working on getting a better night's sleep. So we have to kind of respect that the employer is dealing with individual journeys, which makes it really kind of hard for an employer to provide everything, right? Because we don't expect a company to provide 1,000 different programs for 1,000 different employees, which is why it's so important to create a well-being culture so that everybody has the support they need for their own individual well-being journey.
So you've just written this. It's not out yet, is it? It's out in January.
6 weeks, right.
2023.
That's right.
Yes. And so this book is the blueprint. So I think, and I looked briefly at the blueprint to say that obviously leadership comes very high or at least central to this whole blueprint. But I know there are others as well. So would you like to just talk us through what the blueprint journey looks like and how you
sure.
might implement it?
Sure. A Cure for the Common Company was written primarily for managers, leaders, and human resource professionals so that they could know how to, or their role in creating this well-being culture. There are six building blocks to create this well-being culture, and depending on your organization, depends on where you might start, but they all interact with each other and they're all equally important. It's just that a company might have already worked on one area and didn't even realize that they were benefiting the health and well-being of their team. So there's peer support, there's leadership engagement, as you mentioned, Kate, norms are shared behaviors, shared expected behaviors. There's social climate, how we feel about the people we work with and the organization with whom we're employed. Then there are shared values. These are the things that the company holds in highest regard, the priorities. And finally, culture connection points. Culture connection points are the nudges and the resources that the employer provides to make it easier for employees to make healthy choices throughout the day.
So when I was thinking about the, what was I thinking about there? You said something that triggered something to ask you. I can't remember what it was. It was very profound, obviously. So profound, I can't remember.
It just blew your mind away.
It'll come back anyway. But I think it was as well. So there's quite a lot of different petals to that flower.
Yes.
Like. So where absolutely. Do you sort of start? Because as you were talking, I was thinking, leadership, but it sounds like our values, that's what I was thinking about, is the values really come from leadership, don't they? So do they, or is it something different?
Well, most of the time, the leadership hands down the values, but that may not be the best way for an organization to determine their values. In fact, this building block is specifically called shared values. And that's because the values that the organization lands on really will be much more impactful and effective if they resonate with the employees and not just be what the employer or the company wants. And so if a value for the employer is accountability, you know, we're going to hold you accountable. If you mess up, then you're in big trouble. That says something very different than a value of collaboration, which really implies, hey, we're going to work together to make sure we're successful. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't all be accountable and do a good job, but to have that word be the focus of the organization, as opposed to collaboration, as an example, sends a very different message. And it sends or creates a possibility of a very different work pattern.
So how do those values emerge?
So there are companies who create shared values as an exercise between the leadership team and either sample of the workforce, if it's a really large company, or the entire workforce, if it's a smaller company. And I'll give you two examples. Zappos, the shoe company, when it was younger, had maybe 100 or a couple of hundred employees. And when they created their values, they were able to do that by providing a survey to all of their employees. So that worked for that size. Now, Johnson & Johnson is a global giant, more than 100,000 employees, and that would be pretty tough. But just a few years ago, before the pandemic, they brought together, Kate, I think a couple of thousand employees and leaders to do an exercise over the course of 1 or 2 days where they were able to update their shared values. That was a major investment on their part. However, it helped them assure that the employees were represented on this new or augmented direction.
Well, then it is about the leadership, isn't it? I mean, I'm focusing on leadership because this is where I see sometimes everything fall down, which is, well, you know, I don't know if you see that, your end of the pond, but
listen, I've been doing, you know, we've both been in this work for decades, and there are other professionals who are trying to help employees with their health and well-being. And what I always find challenging is getting managers and leaders at all levels to do their part. We all need to contribute. And that is a major thrust of why I wrote the book and why, if a manager, leader, or human resource professional reads it, they're going to know how they can help contribute to a well-being culture.
Yeah, and they have, as you so rightly alluded to there, they have to sort of believe it, because it's the same thing with the values, which is, I always call it kind of like, you know, in the old days, you know, in the 70s when they had the Miss World contests, and the lady would be standing there going, oh, what do you believe in? They go, oh, I believe in world peace. And, you know, like, and actually you're going, yeah, you don't really believe in world peace, do you? You're just saying that to get the prize, you know. So, I mean, sometimes it's a bit like that in corporate, I think, sometimes where they can say things like, oh, our values are integrity and all the rest of it. But how do you kind of get to that step of getting belief there, which is something, you know, which in other words, they all stand behind and authentically really believe so that they can carry that. Because I think as well, from what you said, that leadership thing is really important, obviously. And the value thing, I think, is so important too, because that is the core running through everything.
Right. It's the guiding principles for how we make decisions work-related. So, Kate, all different types of leaders, and they probably have different messages that will resonate with them. I think it's important for leaders to take some time to either listen to a few podcasts or read a book or two to help them appreciate that this isn't just people giving lip service. There's research behind this. And for example, latched on to the shared values building block. There's an author, Richard Barrett. He's English, and he wrote The Value-Driven Organization. And that's chock full of research that supports the connection between the importance of an organization's values and the success of that organization. And, you know, there's so many different resources that leaders can turn to, and there's so many different benefits that different leaders can embrace, that everybody should find a way to recognize the connection between employee health and organizational success.
Okay, so those petals of your,
yes,
I don't know what you call it, but I'm calling it,
I call
it
them building blocks, but
building
petals
blocks
is such,
you see,
a nice,
you're practical
analogy.
I'm being the sort of like airy fairy nutritionist here, you know, like the petals, but yeah, the building blocks is better. So what are the other building blocks that you have?
Sure. So peer support, how coworkers support each other, or in some cases don't support each other. And that can either be good for our health or bad for our health. I mentioned leadership engagement. There's specific roles that leaders need to have. By the way, leaders influence all these other petals or building blocks, but they also have some specific responsibilities. There's norms. There are ways for employers and team leaders to influence and create healthy norms. We talked about shared values a bit. Then there's the social climate, which is the way team leaders can help the employees on the team feel good about where they work and who they work for. And then there's these culture connection points, these nudges that employers can bring to their employees to make it easier to make healthy choices.
So we've got, have we got all those petals in now? Yeah, the we have, haven't we? The all of the different elements that you have. So how can you then encourage the companies not to just do the, which happens, you know, it's, we're coming up to the new year,
yeah,
and we're coming up to the new sort of new me, new world, new
yeah,
whatever, you know, let's do everything differently,
right,
and let's really attack the well-being thing for a month,
yeah,
and then let's just go back to where we were.
So most companies do or provide a lot of culture connection points and just their resources and programs. And they can be very good resources. So, Kate, I'm sure that you provide an excellent resource to the employees who you work for. But wouldn't it be great if the employer took an additional step and provided some other culture connection points around nutrition? What if in their cafeteria or their vending machines, they were sure to offer more healthy choices and then put a symbol in front of them, so that it made it easier for the employees to know which foods to pick, and go a step further, put those choices front and center, instead of having candy bars at the checkout or candy bars right at the visual eye level, make sure that they're a little bit lower and put the healthier choices more apparent. I'm gonna go one step further, Kate. When I started working at Hopkins, the cost of a bottle of water was more expensive than a can of soda. That's no longer the case. We need to make sure that our healthy foods and drinks are less expensive than the unhealthy ones.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, I remember doing a big health and safety conference, which was all about well-being. I mean, they were launching their well-being strategy. As we came out, it was literally, they were serving fish and chips and wine. It's like, really? Really?
Yeah.
So sometimes you get these disconnects.
Oh,
don't
yeah,
you?
Absolutely. And that was so common in the medical community 30 years ago when I graduated from medical school. They would have a presentation over dinner on heart disease, and they would serve what I consider pretty unhealthy choices.
Yeah, a heart attack on a plate, you
right,
know, just like them. Exactly. Having just talked about the whole thing, it just seems like sometimes these whole things aren't put together. And of course, that can be because different, as you so rightly say, it's really the culture that brings that together, isn't
yeah,
it? I mean, that's
right.
the binding thing.
Yes, our decision makers, our leaders need to be more mindful about what they do, what they say, the policies that they create, and how they impact the health and well-being of their employees. Because otherwise, their employees are going to most likely continue on an unhealthy path. That's just, you know, the statistics speaking, is that as we age, the unhealthy habits that we built as a child and adolescent and young adult get more difficult to change, and then the ramifications of and the onset of illnesses begin to show themselves.
Yeah, it gets to be that it's, you know, I think you don't, when you're younger, you don't really pay a cost, obviously, and people get into bad habits.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and then as we were alluding to, work doesn't really give you sometimes space or time to get up from your desk or do the things. It looks like, well, it's a sort of work ethic thing, isn't it? Which is like, you don't look like you're working if you're getting up and walking around the office or, you know, taking time to eat lunch as opposed to eating it at your desk or.
Right. I mean, even our leaders, how many leaders were ever trained in how to lead with well-being? Very, very few. Again, something that A Cure for the Common company provides is training for leaders so that they can understand that actually the people on your team will be more effective if they get up and take a break and walk. And if you want to double down on that, get up, take a walk outside so they get a little dose of nature and fresh air during the workday. There's so many strategies that most leaders are overlooking to create a more effective team and a more successful company.
So what you're saying is, and I mean, I'm extrapolating here, but it can be quite good value. I mean, you know, it doesn't have to be, because what I get is pushback from budget or, you know, sometimes And I'm
taking a walk is free.
It's free. But you know, I did a gig once for these. I had a series in this company, which is a law firm, a very, very big, scary city law firm. And the one half of the board, or whatever you call it, partnership, was really up for me doing this. And the other half was just could see these junior lawyers' hour, of which they charge however many pounds an hour, you know, kind of being whittled away. Literally, they were sort of like, you know, 1 hour in the room with the nutritionist, if times 30 is however thousands of pounds that they've just, you know, got rid of. But you know, that isn't really the attitude, is it, really?
Well, it's not a helpful attitude. If we just stay with the law firm example, we know that when people make healthier food choices, they're able to think more clearly. They're less likely to get headaches. They're more likely to have good energy. And all of those things will make these lawyers more successful. The same can be true of taking that walking break that I just mentioned. And if you take the walking break with a colleague, another lawyer for this example, then you could discuss a case and come up with a better solution that you than you might have arrived at by yourself. Kate, I take walking meetings with the people on my team every week, and it's good for our well-being, and we are able to brainstorm and come up with more effective solutions to the challenges that we face.
Yeah, and another disconnect, on the, particularly in the law firms, is, as you said, that with the medical school thing, because they are paid after, they're like junior doctors almost. They have to go through this terrible onslaught of staying up all night and stuff like, and then after a certain hour, they're given food free from the company. And they were just like because they're tired, they just go for all this terrible food, like addictive food, and they're in their vending machines, it's all Coke and all the rest of it. And I'm sure they'll be liable for that in the future, just flagging it here, you know.
Well, it's interesting, you took you picked two professions, lawyers and physicians, and they're very different in a lot of ways. Lawyers are usually sitting most of the day, and doctors are usually standing and walking most of the day, and they do have different needs because of their work circumstances. And it's important for employers to recognize that. What are the specific challenges that my team is facing in order for me to, and how can I address those?
So, you know, going back to our petals or the building blocks, how do we then get those petals or the building blocks that we need to identify those different areas, from norms to leadership to values to all of these different elements? And how do we start kind of building our wellness edifice from the building blocks that you have? I mean, is there an audit that you do? How do you sort of, I say, pat this into a pat of butter, you know, and make it solid and make it something you can grab hold of and do something with?
Right. Well, depending on who the reader is, if you're managing one team, you might think differently. You might know the people on your team very well and know which building block to start with. If you manage the, if you're the CEO, you probably want to look at the whole thing and do an assessment of your well-being culture. And there is an assessment in one of the chapters. So Kate, you have to know your audience. These building blocks are all overlap with each other. They all need to be addressed at some time. And I'm sure that some teams are doing better in some areas than others. I'm sorry, I can't give you a straight answer, but if I were to tell your listening audience, this is the place to start, I might not be giving them the best advice.
No, I know, actually, you're totally right. It's almost like you are looking at a patient and thinking, okay, I need to talk to the patient, find out what's going on with this patient, and then from there make the diagnosis, and from there put in the treatment.
Right. I think that's a brilliant analogy.
You can keep that one.
Well, you know, I have another one. Like, listen, we all need to set the table before we sit down for the meal. And so too often employers are open to providing programs and resources to their employees to support their well-being, but they skip setting the table. And the setting the table is building this well-being culture foundation so that once the meal is served, it's easier for the people at the table to embrace the food that's being offered and digest it well.
Yes, and to take that analogy a bit further, it's like serving them a meal that they actually do want to eat as well.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yes.
Rather than, you know, sometimes it happens with me because obviously nutrition is an interesting subject, as you know, which is either people think they know everything and they know all about it, so they don't need to listen. Yeah. Or they know nothing and have got themselves into a bit of trouble and they don't want to listen because they think I'm going to be telling them off or something, which I never do, of course. So you kind of, you sometimes got these two ends of the spectrum as opposed to, they don't want to be there really. That's you know,
and of course,
hopefully I make them want to be there.
Right. That is a conundrum. You know. You lock the door. Yeah. I mean, well-being and nutrition can be very opinionated because people have their own experiences. But this idea that nutrition can be overwhelming, and I think it's the work you're doing, Kate, is hugely important. And it's very important that the employers support your effort because those employees won't be able to learn everything. So at least if the employer is doing their job, they can make it easier with those culture connection points for the employees to continue making healthy food choices.
So when you're looking at these building blocks and the building you're trying to build, what is your idea of well-being and what does a well company look like for you?
Well, well-being is a journey. It is a journey towards wellness. Wellness to me is an ideal state of happiness and health, and not just the absence of disease and illness, but really optimal state of health. For an organization, organizational health is around how healthy the organization is as a unit, and that is not just about the financial health of the organization. We all know examples of companies that were highly profitable, and then a few months later, they're out of business because they chose to only focus on their financial health at the expense of their infrastructure. And that infrastructure includes people. And when the people leave, guess what? There goes your company. So organizational health is a much more broad look at how the condition of all aspects of the business, including the health and well-being of the workforce.
So sometimes these, you know, what we find here, and I'm sure it's the same with you as well, is that sometimes these wellness themes run in cycles and they run in themes without looking holistically. So of course we've had mental health as one big theme here. I don't know if you share that in the States, and now it's actually the menopause, which is it's just like, you know, I'm like, great, you know, I mean, meaning that being a postmenopausal woman, I'm like, okay, I can tell you all about that, guys, you know. But you know, meaning they just sometimes I that's fine. But in one way, it's focusing just on one aspect, like especially both of those examples are focused on just one aspect. And of course, I always try and say to people, of course, good mental health is good physical health. I mean, we are, you know, you haven't got your head disconnected from your body.
No,
you know,
we don't.
But so how do you get over that? I think that is a cultural thing, meaning, you know, let's not concentrate on nutrition because we need to concentrate on mental health now.
Yeah. So marketing and communications are a culture connection point. That's an example of a culture connection point. And it is true that companies have themes around well-being. And I think you identify a pretty common challenge. How do we send a message of supporting health and well-being without excluding other parts of health and well-being? And to give you an example, we start every January at Johns Hopkins with a message, a well-being theme. And in January, our message for the year will be the we in well-being. And our message is, hey, we don't need to address our health alone. We can work together to improve our health and well-being. And so by sending that message, we don't exclude any health, whether mental health, physical health, financial health, social connected, it embraces all of it. And I would encourage every company to rethink about how they message for that very reason, Kate, that we don't exclude nutrition or menopause in the messaging that we send.
Yeah, because it can be, I think it is companies genuinely obviously trying to help and address something they see as something that they need to address. But, you know, what you get is a whole lot of people who don't want to be labeled with a mental health condition, but they definitely still need help, you know. And
yeah.
And actually that help might come from a physical route, you know, it might come from, you know, having 17, which I've had actually, which is Coke. You know who I mean, soda soda bottles, you know, like this. Actually, what it was, the diet version and the other company, funnily enough, but drinking two liter bottles a day, 4 liters a day.
Yeah.
And consequently, you know, be with just with the caffeine, that's quite a lot of caffeine, obviously. So
yeah. You know, a lot of people at least 10 years ago when we took on the soda challenge, we're unaware of the health challenges that consuming soda brings. And so part of a marketing communications campaign is to be clever in how we communicate. I don't know if you've ever read the book Made to Stick by the Heath brothers, Dan and Chip Heath, but they do a brilliant job of helping the reader understand how to create impactful messages. And we've benefited from their work, and we created some really awesome ways, different ways, because people received messages differently to communicate that. And we had many, many employees who thanked us, literally saying they never realized how much sugar was in soda and what kind of health problems that sugar was causing them.
Yeah, so absolutely, and using messaging for the good is obviously a good,
yes,
good thing. Obviously, there's, yes, a very thin line on that one as well.
Oh,
but,
yeah.
But yeah, no. But actually, that's the thing, because some of these things are done very unconsciously. You know, like downing liters and liters of soda is a very unconscious thing.
Yeah.
Actually, and you need an interruption in that pattern. And as you say, you know, the company is responsible in one way, because of course, if they you know, could take breath away from, you know, they weren't being worked quite so hard, you know, not hard, I don't mean that way, but in effect, you know what I mean? They're what's being pushed without taking breaks, without having access to the environmental aspects of health that can give rise to them flourishing in their company. Because, I mean, we were saying before we came on, you know, a lot of these problems are environmental, aren't they? I mean, meaning access to sugar, and I mean, in my city, the school children literally walk up to a shop which is called Poundland, which is just like, you can buy everything for a pound, clue,
yeah,
in the title, and they buy their breakfast there, which is just sweets, that's, you know, candy. So that's what they do. So, you know, it's an environmental thing and a time thing, because they haven't been provided breakfast. You know, their parents may be very busy, they might not have the money. All of these things play into a huge, complicated dynamic.
Yeah, and environmental design is another culture connection point. Employers can purposefully design their workplace so that it's easier for employees for their health to benefit. You brought up the notion of home, and homes have cultures. And our homes influence us not only when we're at home, but when we're at work. And so I specifically call out strategies in A Cure for the Common Company to help leaders understand what they can do to support the home and recognize the home influences the workday. Very important part of the big well-being picture.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, it sounds fascinating. So obviously, we alluded to at the beginning of the call that John Hopkins might have be your sort of like lab in a way to try some of these ideas out. Is that the case?
Well, it's not just Johns Hopkins. The book is filled with stories from different companies who are using some or all of these building blocks without knowing, possibly, that they were drawing on the different social sciences that support these building blocks. So the readers will be able to get a good flavor for all of the different possibilities and then be able to take what they're learning from reading these stories and apply it to their team and their whole workforce. But to Kate, to your point, I'm not just writing this book. I've studied the research and we're actually doing it at Hopkins and seeing the results. So the readers can have some confidence that this material has a basis. And in fact, there are dozens of references in every chapter.
So when you sort of came to this idea of writing the book, I mean, obviously the book is just the culmination of many, many years of actually implementing the strategies that you've talked about. But what can you give us a sort of case history maybe around the work you've been doing there, or another case history of like, okay, so company B has kind of like suddenly woken up and seen the light and said, oh my goodness, he's right. How do they get started, or have you got an example of how you did that and got started?
Yeah, sometimes a new leader will come into a company and they'll see it after they've, you know, studied their new environment for a few months. And, you know, that could be their light bulb. But more often, employers are kind of slowly going through this dance and evolving their thinking and commitment. I'll just give you an example at Hopkins of how we got started, and just kind of maybe it was a light bulb, but it was really more of a jarring the senses. So, Kate, I previously shared this story with you that I was walking on the Hopkins campus about 3 months after starting my job, wondering how was I going to possibly change the culture in this huge organization whose priority is to provide world-class healthcare to our patients, not to think about our own health. And I came across what I thought was a fire truck because it was this big red truck. And it actually, when I paused to look at it more closely, it turned out to be a soda truck. And not only was I looking at a huge soda truck outside of our flagship hospital, it was actually parked in the loading dock area, and it was parked underneath a sign that just was a big E. And I'm thinking, what is that E? And you know what? The light bulb went off inside of me that said, hey, that big E was the old emergency room sign. That's where the emergency room used to be. And the irony did not escape me. And that's what my gut kicked in and said, this is what we need to tackle first. And we got a lot of momentum out of that. And as an institution, a lot of light bulbs were going on. It was like, you know, oh my gosh, here we are treating people with heart disease, diabetes, cancer, and helping them realize that what they eat is impacting their chances of survival and future illness. And yet we're drinking this stuff ourselves. So maybe, you know, there's a light bulb example for you.
So did you start by kind of like saying, okay, well, that's the end of that delivery? Or did you sort of...
well, we don't... You... yeah. So we take, we take a tempered approach. You know, one thing employers need to be mindful of is that, you know, we don't ever want to come across like we're the parent and we know better. But we do want to increase awareness, options, and opportunities and make it easier to support health and well-being. So we looked at this in a few different ways, Kate. We looked at the access points. So where is soda being offered in our institution? It's being offered in cafeterias, in vending machines. At the time, it was being offered in meetings. And then how is it that these choices are being made? We looked at the cost of soda. We looked at where it was placed. We looked at how it was being marketed inside our buildings. And we addressed all of those areas. We adjusted our strategy. Mm-hmm. We now make sure that 80% of the drinks that are sold in our walls qualify as a healthy option. We also make sure that water costs less than soda. And I gave you some other examples before about how we adjusted. But if you want to get an unhealthy soda, you can find it. is just not going to be as prominent.
Yeah, well, it's that environmental thing as well, which is, you know, this is the thing, which is, you know, and things that are slightly difficult, you know, do put barriers in the way. You know, cooking is difficult. It puts barriers in the way of people getting home and wanting to cook or feeling inspired to cook, and exercise, you know, exercise. If you make it easy with loads of elevators or, you know, lifts, as we call them here, you know, it's going to be tricky. But if you, you know, give people options to be able to walk up the stairs, I suppose these are the things you mean.
So buildings have to have stairs if there's more than one flight in case of an emergency. And most often companies are not making their stairs prominent. The elevator bank tends to be in the center and the stairs are somewhere you got to go hunt them down. If that's the case, why not put a sign up in the elevator bank that just simply says stairs, maybe some happy faces with an arrow pointing toward the stairwell. And inside the stairwell, maybe you could put on the walls, if you can't afford a fresh coat of paint, maybe you make a contest in your organization for artwork, and whoever artwork wins gets affixed to the walls inside the stairwells. It not only makes it a more enjoyable walk up and down the stairs, but it could help make people feel good and share something personal about themselves.
So that sort of soda example sounds like a big win there. Has there been any other big shifts, huge shifts that you've made? And what has been the result of those shifts? Yeah. Can you measure those?
Sure. Well, we have a huge win by using the Center for Disease Control Worksite Health Scorecard. So in the United States, we have a public health organization called the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. And they have an organizational assessment tool called the Worksite Health Scorecard. And it has 16 categories that include things like depression and stress, diabetes, heart disease, but also habits like nutrition and smoking. And over those 16 categories, there's more than 100, and I think there's about 168 questions. And these are what the CDC is asking employers to address. And when we started using that tool about 8 years ago, we were actually scoring below benchmark. We did not do as well as the average organization. And now we're at the top. We're like scoring in the 90th percentile in almost every category. And so each of those categories has a variety of different questions. So I'm just going to focus on the tobacco. Very few people smoke nowadays, but, you know, 40 years ago, half of our population smoked. It was crazy. When I started working at Hopkins, we have many campuses because we're huge. We're not just in Maryland, but in other parts of the United States. There were two campuses that did not yet have no smoking policies on campus. And so there's a win right there. We changed that, and there's many, many other successes.
Yeah, that seems pretty easy just to put a no smoking policy, doesn't it?
It's just one would think, but you have to watch the pushback. And what happened is some people started getting in their cars in the parking lot to smoke. One would think it was easy, but it, you know, health and well-being is not easy. That's right. It's an addiction. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. So then I suppose there are strategies there to help, you know, in other words, take it on a step to say, okay, it's not the smoking, it's the addiction. We need to deal with the addiction.
Yes. So in addition to providing resources like the nicotine patches and the gum and one-on-one coaching, there's also that social construct, the we and well-being. People are more likely to be able to quit smoking when they quit with someone else. And part of being addicted to tobacco is having formed friendships with other smokers. And the same can be true with nutrition. People eat very similarly to what their friends eat or what their family eats. And so we need to be strategic like that, Kate, in order to be more successful in supporting health and well-being.
Yeah, and I think it all comes back to actually personal values, not only just corporate values, because, you know, actually, that's one of the most important things when I look at coaching people outside the just the nutrition space, but it's kind of like the why, the compelling why is the thing. You know, if you don't have that compelling why, then you might as well just smoke and eat rubbish. Because, you know, it's just like, why? I mean, I'm enjoying it. It's kind of hitting some kind of spot and it's addictive. And, you know, I get a bit of a high from it, from the food I'm talking about. You know,
sure.
You just feel good in the moment and then feel rubbish, obviously.
Oh,
so
yeah.
It's like the why is, why would you get out of bed? You know, it might be about your grandchildren. It might be about, I don't know what it might be about. But it's that sort of like, I need to do this because, not just I need to do this. Would you agree?
Most people who are successful and living a healthy and well life have a reason, a benefit in mind, if not one, probably multiple. And sometimes it's just, I want to just feel well. I'm tired of being tired all the time. I need to work on my sleep, and this is how I'm going to do it. And this is the help I need from my employer.
But do you think to this crunch point? You know, I think a lot of people, they don't address well-being until there's a critical moment, like a heart attack or something.
Well, everyone's different. That is one wake-up call. I mean, there is a trans-theoretical model of behavior change that Jim Prochaska brought to the science community, and it's entered the more individual community, and that's an example of what's called dramatic relief and can move people from a pre-contemplation stage where they had no concept that they were going to do anything to a greater sense of urgency to make a plan and get moving. But Kate, everyone's different. And sometimes it doesn't take a heart attack. Sometimes it takes a supportive spouse or a supportive friend who shows concern and a willingness to do this alongside them. I always say well-being is a team sport. And because most of us are much more successful in helping or moving our well-being journey along when we're doing it with others.
So I'm springing this on you, but Rich.
Sure.
But so how do you embody well-being? I mean, what do you do as an individual?
I appreciate the question. I have a lot of well-being habits. I was fortunate to grow up. My father exemplified to me the love and the need to move and to exercise. So that's been part of my routine since I was a child. I have also ate pretty well as a kid. I started to eat even better when I got my nutrition degree and I learned more in my college education. And fortunately, as an adult, I learned the value of yoga and mindfulness, and that's part of my daily practice as well. To be honest, my sleep is better than it used to be, but I could use a little help with my sleep. I know that my sleep is tied to my workday. I sleep better on the weekends. I sleep better on holidays, on vacation. And even though I sleep well some work nights, I don't sleep well every work night. Last night, for full disclosure, I only got 5 hours of sleep, and I don't know that I'm embarrassed to say it because I think it probably is true for many other people, but I'm sorry I didn't get the 7 or 8 hours I usually do.
Well, I think that's the thing, which is about being honest about, you know, that even if you're in well-being, like I am, I mean, my big issue is exercise. I mean, I do yoga, actually.
Yeah, great.
You know, Adrienne, I think she's called Adrienne. She's from Texas and she's got a video series.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like the 30-day morning yoga challenge
day.
With Adrienne.
I love it. We're coming since lockdown.
I know who you're talking about.
We've done it every day. Yeah.
That's funny.
We've done it every day since. So that's been a real rock for us, you know,
good.
For my husband and I. But actually getting out, and I'm not a runner and I'm not a sports. I tried to play tennis and broke my knees falling on the concrete. That was the end of that career. So I'm just looking, and I now have bought myself a little trampoline, you know, one of those trampettes. I'm hoping that's going to do it because it kind of looks fun. So we all have our little Achilles heels. So we can't be perfect, Rich, you know.
No, and trying to be perfect is probably not good for our well-being. It just adds stress to our day, right? I mean, we have to love ourselves because if we don't, that's going to cause us some emotional turmoil.
But, you know, the most off-putting thing about well-being people generally is that they're trying to be perfect or pretending to be perfect, you know, and actually, yes, you put the big blocks in, you know, like good nutrition. And obviously being outside is an important thing. I think getting the light. Yeah. So more than me pelting around the park, you know, in my gym shorts, which would actually, I think, probably be a fright to everybody. I do like to get out and see the sun and, you know, today we're lucky we've got the sun in Britain, so that's amazing. Yeah. But obviously the light is important for sleep and all the rest of it. So there are other ways. And, you know, the big one is lightness of character and sense of humor, you know, as opposed to stress. You know, stress is obviously a huge, huge burden for a lot of people.
Without a doubt. You know, it's got to be somewhere around... It was somewhere around 90% at one point during the pandemic, which is just huge. You may or may not be familiar that our School of Public Health provided the COVID dashboard that showed the number of diagnoses around the globe, but they also did a lot of research around the health impact, including mental health. And so, at one point during the height of the pandemic, 90% of respondents were saying they were stressed.
Wow. Yeah, that's amazing. Who were the 10%? Maybe they
Maybe
they were living in the Himalayas somewhere then.
I'm thinking so. I wished I was one of those 10%.
Yeah, exactly. Wouldn't you like to be that? It's just like, oh, is anything wrong here? What's happening? You know, it's like, no. Well, as we come to the end of the interview, thank you so much. Please give us your references again, the book, the published date, how we can get hold of it.
And sure.
Anything else you think is relevant?
Great. A Cure for the Common Company. I really think leaders and managers, human resource professionals, even people in our space, Kate, those of us who help support employee health and well-being will gain a lot by consuming the information in those pages. If you want to follow me on LinkedIn, I post about well-being culture pretty regularly, so you can get more familiar with the content. And if you want a big dose of me, richardsafir.com. Otherwise, the book is available for pre-order pretty much everywhere where you order your books. They're going to be shipped on January 19th. So I hope you'll embrace the opportunity.
Well, thank you so much for talking to us today. I know lots of people will follow you on LinkedIn. And just your name again, the spelling of it is S-A-F-E-E-R. Yes.
Am I right? That is correct.
Yes,
that is
fantastic.
Correct.
So, Richard, thank you so much for having spoken to us today. And thank you for your work and your passion and your commitment. It shows through. And you know, that's the thing, is it's the end person that we've got in mind, the individual person who can live a much better fulfilled life, being at the top, you know, that idea of the World Health Organization definition of well-being. So thank you.
Without a doubt, you know, hundreds of millions of people are working and we have an opportunity to support their health and well-being.
Yes. And with your strategy, we can start to do that. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Kate.